This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Roman is present. And Jonathan, last weekend, the DA had their something conference. I can't remember.
Yes.
Which conference?
It's their national conference.
Right. And on the way here, I saw posters over at the Star, I think it was, or the Citizen. And it says, DA in race war. And I'm like, what is this? And then you read about it. And no, they're just having a conversation about quotas and diversity and things like that. So
I think there's a couple of things there. One is that, remember, it's a conference. It's the Federal Congress, and as far as I understand, there are many, many, many things on the table. It's the same as the ANC having their conference in December. And what you hear in the news was discussed. You'll hear, they discussed land. And that was the big thing discussed. But actually, there might have been 40 other things discussed. And in 2 years' time, there'll be a bill on something that you're like, where did this come from? But actually, it was discussed at the conference.
Sure.
So there are many things on the table. I think we need to be careful about what the things that the media highlights. With the DA, it's always going to be something around race, because they always, even in their supposedly impartial approach, they want to remind you that the DA is the white party, you see.
Right. And meanwhile, it's probably the most diverse party. And I'm talking racially, ideologically, genderally. That's not a word. But in terms of gender.
Well, they may have 72 genders in the DA. Who knows?
So they do quite well on that front. But it's always, so-called the white party. And they're discussing these things. And it's fine. They should discuss them. There's nothing wrong with that. I just hope they don't focus on quotas and things like that, and worry about the fundamental issues, which is freedom, property rights, and freedom of speech. The last one, not so much anymore, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I think the messaging is really where the problem is, and they need to override this media wave, which keeps getting them caught up, where they keep getting caught up in that whole race-based issue, and they need to kind of go, this is who we are, either accept it or you don't, and we're not discussing it anymore. We're over with that. We've got lots of other important things to discuss. This weekend, one of the things on the table, apparently, past weekend, if you're listening to this now, is the child support grants. They want to consider doubling that. Widely amongst the right has been derided as something which is very bad. We don't have the money to double the child support grants, and it's appealing to populism, an EFF position.
But there may be good reasons for doubling the child grant, provided there are cuts in other areas, or they, restricted to the first child only, and not to the two or three that follow.
Yeah, I've got a bit of a nuanced position on that, which we can discuss another time. We'll have a solo show soon, but to discuss a bit about the DA historically, now, and where South Africa is kind of going, someone who was very intimately involved, still is very much has his ear to the ground, and has long been requested as a guest on the show. Joining us on the line from Cape Town is Mr. Tony Leon, the former leader of the Democratic Alliance. Afternoon, Tony. Thanks for joining us, and welcome to the show.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Right. Ramon, I think, has his first question for you.
Well, let's start with the current president. So you wrote a piece saying that he's going to change politics, and the DA needs to, step up to the plate and support him if he's rooting out corruption. That piece was taken out of context in some regards, but you've known him for many, many years, since the CODESA days, in fact. What do you think about him back then and now? Do you think he's the same person?
Well, I don't know, because I last saw Cyril Ramaphosa's about 10 years ago, so I haven't seen him recently. And I missed his migration to the world of business, and his return back to Parliament happened after I left it. So my knowledge and memory of him goes back to a previous era, I suppose. And he's a very effective man. He's very intelligent. He's sophisticated. I mean, as a thinker and a strategist, I think all that is to his credit, and I think will be to the country's credit. I also think he's got a pretty unerring eye for the main chance, and I don't mean that disparagingly, because he knows what he wants, and he generally gets what he wants. Certainly that was my experience of him during the negotiations and also in his capacity, although it's on the other side of him, obviously, when he was Secretary General of the ANC. And so I have quite a high regard for his abilities and for his understanding of the environment in which he's in. He's also got, perhaps Jacob Zuma had as well, so it's not necessarily an advantage. He's got, you know, pretty good doses of charm. And he's very articulate. And I again, that is an attribute that that I think counts. Jacob Zuma was both innumerate and inarticulate. And so in all respects, I think he's a vast improvement.
Okay, so given that, let's go back a little bit. You know, when you were in charge of the DA in 94, the election poster was all about freedom, federalism, and free enterprise. If you're a classical liberal, even if you're libertarian, that sounds like a very good sort of set of values to be
advertising. Well, it didn't go down very well with the electorate. We got 1.7% of the votes. I wasn't the leader then, incidentally. I became the leader after that deluge, disaster.
Well, the, you know, posters even in the following election were not dissimilar in the idea, although perhaps a little bit more watered down or explained to the voter. I'm trying to get to, we have a DA that's 25 years ago is telling us all about what is really liberalism and what's now classical liberalism, I would suppose. It's a very different looking party today. What do you think has happened over the past 25 years to change that? And do they no longer stand for those values, or is it just messaged incorrectly or in a different way?
Well, I don't know exactly. I mean, I am in touch with the party and some of its leading figures, and I think it's a much bigger party than it was. Although, I mean, it grew under my leadership very significantly, but it's grown further since, which of course is the idea of politics, is to increase your market share. I think there's been in recent times a desire to perhaps dilute or water down some of those values and principles that were articulated early on. And I fully understand that political parties, including the ones that I led, have to be pragmatic. They're not churches or narrow sectional interest groups. They are broad political movements. But I think there's always a danger that if you get too far off the seedlings that you start don't grow significant and sturdy roots, then you can land up twisting in the wind. And I think we've seen a bit of that recently in the party. But I don't think it's clear one way or the other. I think there's quite an interesting contest actually going on this weekend for what the party's core values are about. And maybe something will emerge with clarity after their Congress in Pretoria.
Yes, quite. And that's happening this weekend. Well, for the listeners, it was last weekend. So in terms of specifics, what are you worried about in terms of perhaps the more populist doctrines that are emerging? Personally, I saw it's still up in the air, but Musi said he would like to, you know, double the child grant, for example. And Gwenny Ngwenya, who's the policy head, said, no, it's just on the table. It's not a decision. So, I mean, that's something that, you know, that's an EFF, it's in the EFF manifesto for the past 5 years now. So people are struggling to find an identity within the...
I'm not a believer in the magic money tree, to quote what someone said about Jeremy Corbyn's policies in the UK, because they've all got to be paid for at the end of the day. And the question is, you know, we've got a 50 billion rand black hole in our fiscus at the moment. So how this would be paid for or costed, I have not the slightest idea. But, you know, if the DA is going to be true to its fiscal conservatism, which it still espouses, incidentally, then presumably you can make savings on some items and you can locate them somewhere else. But I just think pushing huge amounts of money into current consumption rather than into longer-term investment for the country and the communities in the country is problematic. But I'm not an expert on how the DA would propose to fund its latest proposal.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with you. However, specifically for the DA, it seems to wrestle a lot with these ideological issues, whereas the ANC flip-flop very frequently without much fanfare, and the EFF are just, you know, intransigent on one aspect or one issue, which is the land, incidentally. But the DA seems to get a lot of flack from us, especially, and from their own voters about just give us, you know, the 10 bullet points, and then we can see whether we agree with them or not. They seem to get a lot more heat for their lack of direction than at the other parties.
Well, I think, first of all, if you're a governing party, I mean a national government, you tend to be judged not so much by what you say, but by what you do. And I suppose the ANC gets a lot of flack for what it does or doesn't do. The DA can't do anything, or no opposition party can at a national level. So what it says, or what it says or contradicts itself saying, tends to get more attention because that's all it's got, is a bullhorn or a megaphone, and it can propose, it can't dispose of things. I think that is just a structural explanation why an opposition party. The other thing is, of course, the DA is much bigger than the EFF. It's about three or four times as large, and it actually governs in a few places where the EFF governs nowhere. So it's probably, you know, of more, if there are U-turns or zigzags, they do tend to get picked up. I also think the other reason is, and this is to the DA's credit, it was ever thus, even when I first led it had seven MPs, there were seven people with huge personalities and many disagreements, is that the DA is in the political sense a broad church. So there are people there who don't all come from the same dumpling, as they say in Afrikaans. And the party has been on a pretty rapid growth path until recently. So it's accumulated quite a lot of joiners later on in this journey. And it's grafted them together. And sometimes, you know, they speak with different voices. So I think it's also the consequence of the party's relatively rapid growth that it hasn't just been of one mind or one sectional viewpoint.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I do get the sense of risk. You know, the Catholic Church was a broad church too before it split, and, you know, there were all the other offshoots for the reasons that you're basically alluding to, which is people come from different backgrounds with different views. One would like to believe that the DA presents some sort of principled stand in a certain section of politics, at least. So that can be quite broad. And obviously, you know, we know that we've got someone like Helen Ziller, who basically believes in the capable state and is essentially a social democrat, all the way to someone like Michael Cardo, who sits in Parliament, who is essentially a classical liberal. So we've got that doesn't strike me as a problem, having those voices within the party. But when we start having and I say we, because I am a DA voter, when we start having voices in the party that are clearly illiberal, who are saying things like, well, maybe we should support race-based discrimination, or maybe we should look at the whole concept of expropriation without compensation, instead of dismissing it out of hand, as any liberal should do. That strikes me as a major issue.
Yeah, I think that is an issue. I'm not sure that... Well, there might be people in the party who want to look at expropriation without compensation. That would be a complete fundamental betrayal of a core principle pillar of the party. They haven't adopted that position. They've taken a pretty definite stand.
They have on that, but on other issues, I think. Sorry.
Well, you see, a few years ago when the party and Parliament initially decided to support this Employment Equity Amendment Bill, which I had opposed the principal act when I was the leader of the party, I took a very sharp position against them in public, and others did. And then Helen Ziller, who was then the leader of the party, then reversed the party position. And there was a whole explanation as to what she called an anatomy of a plane crash or a train wreck or something. And they did come to the right conclusion, having gone through a very messy process. So I think it does depend on the leader or the core leadership of the party. If they are liberal or they stick pretty closely to the party's core ideology, then the party will have a core. If they don't, then it won't. And, you know, then you get into a sort of position like the old, I suppose listeners have to be of a great age to remember this, the United Party, which essentially was not a bad organization. I mean, they were against the National Party, but they had no ideological core. So they had a conservative voice in the rural areas of white South Africa, a more liberal voice in the urban areas, and eventually the party fell apart. So if a party does not have a core, then indeed that will happen, unless it's in the happy position that it, you know, has so much patronage and so much space that it governs that it really can be a bit of things. So to the extent that it might have issues with discovering or rediscovering its core, it's an exercise that's got to go on, because otherwise, over time, whatever gains the party's made will decrease, and then it will be stuck with very little indeed.
Yeah, no, well, we can't disagree with you there. So in terms of leadership, so Musi, of course, is the leader. You spoke quite highly about him. I think you were on 702 earlier this week, if I'm not mistaken, saying that, you know, he's got what it takes to become president, maybe not the votes as such yet, but he's got the stature, he's got the oral skills.
Yeah, I think he's got a lot of gifts was the word I used. Yes. And, I've encouraged him. I'm not, he doesn't come to me for instruction, but we do get together from time to time, and I give him my support, because I happen to know there are only very few people in this country today alive who can tell you what it takes to lead the official opposition. It's not an easy job. So I try and encourage him where I can. And I generally am supportive. But, you know, I don't sort of get involved in the day-to-day management issues or leadership of the party.
No, sure. And my personal issue with Musi Maimane is that when you see him on stage in front of a church, he's great. He's got that preacher, that the way he talks, the just power that emanates from him when he's talking about religion is really good. And then he talks in front of politics or he talks in front of a political crowd, and it's a lot more muted for some reason. And I'm wondering why the DA chooses to almost negate, you know, that sense that he has when he's talking in church. Because in church he's great, even though I don't believe what he says. But in politics, it's a bit more softer.
Well, I can't answer that question. You'd have to speak to the people who manage his appearances. I really don't know. And I've never seen him in church, and I've only, you know, occasionally seen him in Parliament or in public. But he always seems quite fired up on the occasions I've seen him.
What do you make of the, you know, ongoing, and it's now more during your time, and it never stops really, the ongoing accusations with regards to the racial diversity of the party? Of course, the left only really likes diversity of skin color and diversity of gender and all that. They don't really like diversity of thought. Which is ideally what you'd like in a political party. But what do you make of this push that keeps coming back to the DA that basically they must reflect demographic?
Yes, I think it's complete rubbish. The idea that somehow you should have demographic proportional representation is absolutely Favudian. It is the complete opposite of genuine diversity. That is sort of racial bean counting and percentages. And I completely disagree. The party should disagree. I don't know, we'll see this weekend whether it does, doesn't, with the idea that somehow demographics is destiny, that group membership is something that is imposed on you from birth through your race color. It is completely antithetical, anathema, antagonistic to even the broadest interpretation of liberal democracy, because what at the end of the day is liberal principle? The foundational one has to be, it certainly was ever since I started in politics and developed some thoughts of my own, that the individual is the touchstone of value in any society, not the group. And groupthink is not just group rights of very, very dangerous things. Of course, you've got to take into account communities. You've got to take into account history. I accept all that. I think the reason why it finds a place in some purchase in the DA is something I identified, you know, more than 10 years ago when I was still leader of the party. And it's a simple, perhaps chilling proposition. And that is, when you have an organization like the ANC, which has, over the last two decades, become so hegemonic that it wants to control everything in society. And by and large, it has succeeded, if one's honest about it. So
yeah,
most newspapers, most radio stations in this country, although they might, you know, be very principled and brave on individual acts of malfeasance, such as we saw with Zuma, subscribe to, have bought into a hegemonic idea. And that basically is what is called transformation, which is one of the, in my view, most weasel words in South Africa in the lexicon. By weasel words, I mean it's been all the real content of the word or the idea has been sucked out of it. And transformation doesn't stop at the, you know, doors of the Luthuli house. It runs like a river right through South Africa, often like a sewer, I'm sorry to say, in view of how it pollutes a lot of people's thinking. And I'm not talking about genuine transformation, where I mean that the ability and the necessity of change. I'm talking about a sort of reductio ab absurdum, that the only form of transformation is when you have, you know, 80% of every institution coming from a certain racial group, or anyone who comes from the majority group is deemed to be progressive, and anyone coming from a minority group is deemed to be reactionary. And, you know, there are innumerable and very sad examples of this, and they go right back to the beginning of our democracy here. So to imagine that the DA could exist as some kind of island or some kind of citadel that would be removed from all that is wishful thinking. So that idea, because it is so prevalent, and the ANC is very deliberately, and its satraps and civil society have made it so, washes straight through the DA. The question is whether or not the party will have the intellectual courage to resist it becoming the defining characteristic. Because if that actually becomes, I'm not saying it is, and I'm not saying it will be, but if it becomes the foundational, a foundational principle of the DA, then actually you've got to say the party really has ceased to exist as a definitive counterforce for the intellectual fight or the political fight for the future. Then it's just become another version of what's on offer from the governing party.
And that's an accusation thrown quite constantly at the DA these days. But that's quite perceptive, because I also, you know, transformation is very a weasel word. And that's the essence of state capture for me. So a lot of people make, you know, noise about the Guptas and that criminal enterprise. And of course, they should be prosecuted. But the real state capture is the National Democratic Revolution rhetoric that comes out, where the hegemonic ideas of the society are determined by, you know, the ANC, NEC in essence, and the policies of the ANC. And if you're against those policies, you're a racist and an apartheid apologist. And those ideas have spread so thickly into the ether of a society. I mean, you can just write something against BEE on legal grounds, for example, and you become a pariah. And that's the power of the ANC, which people, you know, find it difficult to extract from.
Well, you know, when I, after the rather difficult election campaign in 2004, when I went up against the hegemon called Thabo Mbeki and his party, I was, you know, feeling a little bruised, but all the party had done better than done election four. And my great friend of mine, who's an advocate in Cape Town, phoned me up and said, well done, just stiffen your back for the next 5 years. And actually, you know, a stiff back and an erect posture is precisely what people expect of opposition leadership. And if you haven't got that, if you're going to bow down or say, I don't know what the colloquial expression, I remember it in Afrikaans, jammer dat ek leef, because, you know, I come from the other side, then you're really not fit for purpose. You're not cut out to be opposition leadership. So, yeah, I think it does require a degree of moral courage, but, you know, heaven knows, there's been no shortage of that in human history, and there's been no shortage of that actually in South Africa, even under apartheid.
Mm.
I think there was a tendency when democracy arrived on these shores, or was fought and won in 94, to assume that actually, you know, the essential battle had been won and everyone could go back to their, you know, peacetime jobs. Well, it's not so. It never was so, and it's certainly not so today.
What do you make of some of the chilling effects that are happening with regards to expression, freedom of speech? I know you've written on Vicky Momberg. That's a specific case.
I haven't actually written about my colleague Douglas Gibson.
Sorry.
But I agree with him completely. I mean, I think she's a terrible racist. I also think she probably deserves psychiatric treatment rather than prison. And but I think, you know, a very clear message is being sent down, although I need to hasten to add, wearing the fact I'm a detribalized legal academic and attorney, that what magistrates decide, they are the lowest form of legal judicial officer. It is not binding on any other court. And I strongly suspect, if she could find her lawyer that or get one to act for her, that sentence would be reversed on appeal. Because not because what she said wasn't abhorrent and pretty shocking, but you send people to jail for even those, you know, for criminaneuria for 3 years or 2 years, and you have killers who walk free or have less jail time. I don't understand that. They might. I obviously haven't seen the case, and I've only read about it. I haven't looked at the judgment. So I always think one needs to study a judgment before you criticize it. So let me put that in parenthetically. But what really shocked me, strange enough, wasn't so much the judgment and the jail time, but actually that she was denied bail. That I found extraordinary, because that seemed to be an exemplary kind of punishment which wasn't related to the actual facts. Because, you know, I know a bit about law. Bail is only refused when you're a flight risk, or you're in danger to the community, or you can tamper with witnesses, which none of which, you know, seemed remotely applicable in that case. So I suspect the other factors at work there, and I think it's of a piece with a more general trend, although I'm always reminded that, you know, civil rights are meant for the worst of us, not the best of us. So let's assume, and I think it's a fairly good assumption, that Vicky Momberg is a pretty bad person, because someone who can say what she said to the people she said it to has to be actuated by a great degree of racial malice.
And be unapologetic all the way through.
And be and then double down it. So that's why I think what Douglas Gibson says, correct, she probably should, you know, be in a psychiatric institution. But that's where your human rights and civil rights get tested. Not you know, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, for example, does not require the protection of the Bill of Rights for his free speech, because, you know, 99.9% of what he says, most of humanity would agree with. Maybe not 99%, but a lot of it.
Yeah.
Vicky Momberg, you know, stands in a very isolated, and I suspect even within the minority, in a very dark and probably intellectually depraved place. But absence of hate speech, which I suppose you could say what she said was hate speech, but then you've got to meet a whole lot of other tests. You know, we tend to protect free speech in this country, and our constitution does. It doesn't protect hate speech. But even then, you've got to ask yourself, well, do you jail people for something like that? And I'd like to read the judgment. I'd like to see what the High Court is going to do with it.
What I think is more of an issue, and you know, that's a specific case, but my concern, and what I've tried to express to people who want to discuss it, obviously Twitter is no longer a place to discuss things, for example, but is that
Twitter, I'm on Twitter. I think we found each other on Twitter, and I have quite a few followers. I'm just amazed at the amount of false information that's peddled there. I mean,
absolutely. So
I saw several times that my father, who is 93 years old, still sort of, you know, he's okay, and not that his actions as a judge are induced. My father is routinely among these Twitterati described as a person who was responsible for the execution of Solomon Mahlangu. Well, it's complete rubbish. He wasn't a judge in the Transvaal.
Sure, and I bet Mahlangu, it gets...
he wasn't the judge. It's just unbelievable.
I bet it gets thousands of retweets, right?
One ignorant echo chamber after another.
Sure, so I don't think even... I've decided after this past week, actually, that it's not actually even an echo chamber. It's a confirmation bias chamber. And so my bigger concern is the chilling on free speech in general. And I think we can bring Winnie Mandela into this a current topic. Obviously, she passed away or died. I don't know. It's apparently racist to say died. She was obviously praised by the people you would expect her to be praised by, but she was also praised by people you wouldn't expect her to be praised by. I thought the DA's take on her death was, on her legacy, so to speak, was quite poor, and didn't emphasize some of the more heinous parts of her existence. I do feel that a lot of that is influenced by this sort of chilling of free speech, where people feel I can't say X or Y.
Well, I'm not going to comment on Winnie Mandela. In life, we had some very, very severe disagreements with each other, and They were done in public. They were done, I did them to her face. And she had something to say about me. And there it is. I don't think this is the right time to start having a contest over her legacy, which I think is multi-layered because there's a period of mourning. But I'm in the public domain on this. So not something I hid away, not something I did behind her back. It was all done in Parliament, it was done in the TRC by me. And she had some things to say about me, and yeah, that a viewpoint about me, and it's all there. In fact, I think quite even-handedly described my many encounters with her in my book On the Contrary, in over 20 pages or in one chapter of that book. And Gareth van Onselen in Politics Web has written a very interesting piece about how the Democratic Alliance has dealt with it. And I'm not going to comment specifically on her, but let me give you an analogy, which I think we can now make because it's highly relevant. And the person was in many ways a very remarkable legislator and was regarded as the liberal lion of the Senate and was very admirable in so many ways. I'm talking about Edward Kennedy. So when Edward Kennedy died in the United States, much cherished by the liberal fraternity, much mourned in Massachusetts, where he'd served as a senator for over 35 years, of course there were tributes and of course there was a great deal of affirmation for his life. But I'm not aware of a single newspaper, even the liberal New York Times or the San Francisco Press, which didn't pretty prominently in the obituaries and in the comment mention the fact that Chappaquiddick had cast a huge shadow over his career. In fact, it probably prevented him from becoming president of the United States in 1980.
Yeah, well, I think 84.
No, 80. Okay. He stood against Jimmy Carter in 1980 for the Democratic nomination. Mm. And that was a failed attempt.
Him.
Yeah. And so I have to say, and, you know, that's America. It's a grown-up country. It's got very robust First Amendment rights, actually stronger than ours. But even the people who were, you know, most affirming of Edward Kennedy's really remarkable political life mentioned that fact because it was part woven into the tapestry and the controversies of his public life and career.
Yeah, I just those listeners who don't know, it just very briefly, he drove off a road into water, essentially with a woman in the car, left the car behind, and the woman actually didn't die of drowning. She suffocated in the vehicle. He didn't call police for 12 hours. He just went home and slept. So it was quite a
10 hours. But the point is made.
Yeah,
and there was allegations of a cover up. I mean, it was a cover up of questions. You know, how complicit was he? And that dogged his career and his public life, although obviously it didn't prevent him being re-elected senator for Massachusetts many times thereafter. But, that is how a grown-up society deals with some of its outsized figures. And, you know, maybe we're not a grown-up society. I don't know if we'll become one. But I think if you want to stunt the growth of a democracy, a nascent democracy like ours, then indeed you chill free speech. And there's a lot of chilling of free speech, but I guess the fact you and I are having this conversation today is proof that not all of society is cowed, not all of it conforms, and long may that continue. Look, you know, I have, although I'm quite polite these days, I'm now 61, I'm 10 years out of politics, I've been an ambassador, but I'm not entirely diplomatic. You know, I have outlets for my views. I'm contracted to write a column in one of the major newspaper groups in this country, Business Day, Sunday Times, Times Direct, you know, so it's not that there's only one viewpoint or voice in our society.
Yeah, and well, the problem is that I'm not too worried about the state trying to infringe my rights. It's about other people that chill it a lot more than the state ever can at this point. They just don't have the capacity to, thankfully, I must add, at this very point. You wrote a column about data from the Institute of Race Relations showing that 1% of respondents in a survey cared deeply about land reform. So if you had to have a guess about this expropriation without compensation motion, is it a ploy to take out the EFF or is the ANC dedicating themselves to dilute property rights quite strongly?
Well, actually, I wrote another column subsequent to that one because I was very involved in that fight around Section 25 of the Constitution, both at CODESA in 1993 and then again in the Constitutional Assembly in 1996. So I'm pretty much a veteran. I still have the scars on my back. And I have to say that not a single word that the EFF has uttered, although arguably they do it slightly more crudely than others, was not present in the chamber when the Constitution was being negotiated in 1996. They didn't wear red overalls or red berets, but they were called the Land Lobby, and they were very loud and very vociferous and indeed enjoyed quite a lot of support in the ANC. And what you have in the current so-called property clause is a compromise between a right of property and a right of land reform in the name of expropriation, and a rather watered down but still quite coherent requirement for compensation, but dependent on several factors. So it's not an unalloyed or unabridged right to property. It's a right not to have your property seized in an arbitrary fashion. And that's very important. And in fact, if we hadn't had that, there wouldn't have been a constitution. I'm not sure South Africa would have been a settled democracy. The concern I have is that somehow, and I try to reiterate this in a column in Business Day, there seems to be an idea that somehow all the constitution is a sort of giving legalistic form to the Freedom Charter. Well, as Cyril Ramaphosa said on the day the constitution was agreed in Parliament, 8th of May 1996, when he was chairman of the Constitutional Assembly, now he's the custodian, chief custodian of the constitution as president, he said, look, there's a fortunate paradox here. This constitution doesn't belong to any one party, and therefore it belongs to all the parties. And that was entirely correct. Again, you know, the penny sparrows or some black racist on the other side might need the protection of the constitution much more than people who have completely conventional views, because the majority doesn't require a constitution. It's there for the people who have minority or individual rights in need of protection. Otherwise, the government could just legislate however it wanted to, if it has a majority, which this one has, by more than 60% of the seats. So there's some specific protections of the Constitution. If they get watered down further, then essentially you don't have a Constitution with the paper it's written on, because as the Indian Supreme Court held way back in 1970, if you take away one fundamental right in the Constitution, you actually start collapsing the whole Constitution, or words to that effect. And then you'll be living under an unconstitutional state, effectively, for all purposes. So I think this is quite a dangerous moment if this thing goes ahead, and it's interesting to see why it needs to go ahead, since the government or the state has many other weapons at its disposal, not least its own very poor record on land reform, on rehousing people, on reimagining agricultural projects, on giving away title, which it very seldom does, to individual previously dispossessed black landowners, and indeed an expropriation bill, which is quite generous to the state, and is currently sitting with the president, and furthermore, a court case adjudicated by the Constitutional Court some 3 years ago, the Agri-SA case, which actually narrows the grounds on which you can claim that there's a compensation is due under an expropriation, because it narrows the grounds where you can say it's an expropriation at all.
And ownership. That's
a question of custody. When does the state become a custodian or an owner? And the provisions under expropriation and compensation only kick in when the state is acting as an owner, not as a custodian. Right, that's a technical argument about mining rights and water rights, but it applies across the board. So there's a lot of generous provisioning for the state to embark on quite wholesale land reform projects without going around taking away people's property rights or rights of possession. And so it clearly isn't needed for that purpose. It might be needed because some people want to level the score. I mean, you know, I will quote Winnie Mandela, but something she said while she was alive, and it's certainly given voice more in the EFF today than the ANC, but some people in the ANC think so. She said that Mandela, her former husband Nelson, and the other ANC leaders were guilty in the 96 Constitution of an economic betrayal of blacks. And I think that, you know, the Section 25 of the Constitution is saying that people see and think, well, let's water that down, throw it out, and then we've leveled the playing fields more in our favor. But it's a very dangerous stratagem, that, for the reasons I've said.
Yeah, I mean, cannot agree with you more. We did a podcast on that section a few weeks ago and received a lot of a lot of emails concerning it. So, Tony, last question from me. Long term, I doubt DA could win 2019, if I'm really honest with you. But long term, do you see coalitions being the supreme political mechanism for South Africa?
Well, I don't know. Look, no time in human history has any political party in this country ever, under the previous dispensation or this one, gone from, 22% to 50%. So, quite clearly, the DA is not going to more than double its support in one election, particularly with Ramaphosa in charge of the other side. Might have had more chance under Zuma. It's clearly much less of a prospect. Now, I also frankly don't think the ANC will go below 50% in the next election in 2019 on a national level. Some things might happen in the provinces. Of course, at local government, we have got a whole lot of coalitions or non-coalitions, one of which is under huge stress in Port Elizabeth. But I think multi-party governments generally can be useful. They're very difficult to make coherent because everyone has a different core principle, and then you land up with a sort of a bare bones agreement on what you're going to do, and there's not much you can do to advance your program in a real sense. And that's probably why you don't see in Johannesburg or Pretoria clear DA policies being implemented, because one of the few things the EFF and the ANC and or the DA and the IFP and whoever else in that agreement can agree on is that they don't like corruption. So they take strong action against corruption. That's a very good thing, of course, for citizens and for governance purposes. But when you get beyond that, well, what do you agree upon? And they probably don't agree on very much. So I think coalitions can work, but they're also quite difficult to introduce radical political change via a coalition government.
Yeah, and we've seen the danger that coalitions or at least agreements have, PE being the example recently with the attempt to remove Ethel Trollope because the EFF were angry with the DA, so they attempted to punish them. And I think that's where political disagreement comes in and having some maturity. In terms of the country as a whole, we're in a bit of a hole, so to speak. We've got a big and rising debt to GDP ratio. We've got potential issues around just monetary flows. We've got problems with foreign direct investment based on some political decisions that are being made. And obviously, 25 years of governing, in my opinion, towards socialism has not helped us in the least. Where do you think we end up sort of 10 to 15 years down the line?
Well, at the risk of making an obvious point, we're running out of money, or we've run out of money, and there's a 50 billion rand fiscal black hole in the revenue accounts at the moment, state public accounts. And we're very narrow tax base, as you know, of relatively very few personal taxpayers propping up, a great number of people who are not in the tax net for reasons of unemployment or poverty. And we have very low levels of foreign direct investment in this country. And the history of South African political economy going back more than 100 years is that whenever there's been an investment strike against the country, it's usually the government has fallen. Well, that hasn't happened yet. I think Ramaphosa is going to be a sugar rush because he does restore quite a lot of confidence among some key economic players, both here and overseas. And we saw recently with the Moody's rating agency and the World Bank and the IMF. So I think those are not unimportant things. But we can only actually come away from the cliff face, which we're on. We haven't fallen over it, which I think we would have done if the Zuma rule had continued, if we make deep and meaningful structural reforms. And going back to your first question about Cyril Ramaphosa, I mean, Cyril Ramaphosa, and it's a strength and a weakness, is basically a deal maker. He's a consensus seeker, and he believes that, you put people together, you can get an outcome, and everyone will sign on for joint responsibility. And I think there's something to be said for that at certain moments. But our economy requires a lot of shock therapy. Our public sector wage bill needs to be drastically pruned. We need to get people off social grants and into work. We can't get people into work unless we actually make the creation of jobs a more attractive proposition for employers, not just for employees or would-be employees. And I go down a whole long list, which we don't have time to elaborate on in this interview. So I don't see that happening. And absent of those, you know, significant reforms, as I've seen it, you know, and it's not easy. I mean, just look at Emmanuel Macron in France. He's got his essentially elected on his own platform. He went out, he destroyed the two-party system there, created his own party, stood on a reform platform, and now trying to take on the public sector unions and in the French and the train drivers and so on. And he's having a very difficult time of it. He might or might not succeed. The country that I know best next South Africa is where I was posted for 3+ years, Argentina. It's got its first non-Peronist, which is like Peronists like the ANC, president in 2 decades. And he's also on a reform agenda and not having an easy time of it because the vested interests, the unions, the corporatist levels, elements of society push against it. And I don't know whether Macron or Macri will succeed, but you kind of need that approach here. And even if you have it, it's not guaranteed to succeed.
Yeah, and that's true of most democracies. Unfortunately, not everyone could be Margaret Thatcher in this regard. So talking about Margaret Thatcher, this is my final question, Tony. Sorry for keeping you.
Yes, I must go.
The data shows that most South Africans appear to be small C conservatives, worried about the economy, jobs, education, security, the usual things that one would be worried about as a citizen. Is there space for a small, intransigent, capitalist, libertarian type party? I know the DP failed in 94 with those sort of principles, but now, do you think there could be a chance?
Well, I think it's necessary to have that voice, whether that voice is articulated inside the DA is or is stifled inside the DA, we will have to see. But I certainly think that voice and those principles need to be heard. But you've also got to be quite pragmatic. I mean, you've got to, you know, you can be a very specialist niche party, but then that's what you are. You're a niche party. If you aspire to govern, you must have a core, but you must be have a degree of flexibility. And I suppose, you know, that's a question. And I think inside the DA, you've seen quite a lot of views. I think some people think, well, we must get these reforms through because that'll then make sure the party's liberal democratic. And then perhaps other people say, we can't get them through. And I think that the history of the DA, the story of the DA is not concluded yet. But whether it's inside the DA or outside the DA, I'm not aware of any society that's worthwhile, democratic, economically prosperous or free, which hasn't had that voice in the very center of the political discourse. And South Africa is not exempt from that requirement either.
Thank you, Tony. Really appreciate it. I know you are on a tight timeline, and we really do appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. Great to chat.
Thanks. Sean. Thanks very much. Cheers, eh? Okay, so that was some quite insightful, interesting stuff.
Well, I think in he had a 2-minute monotone about the individual,
and it was monologue.
And a monologue, sorry, not monotone. And it was the most, how can I explain, direct and clear political speech, for lack of a better word,
yeah,
about fundamental principles of democracy.
Absolutely.
That I've heard in 20 years.
And very refreshing, because I know he's not in politics anymore, but if and I know there are DA people who listen to this show, guys, why can't you just say that? Like, stuff like that. You know, you have a base, and a lot of your base believes those things. So just verbalize that, and then we can start having conversations about doubling social grants, but and you know, deeper conversations about what that means. But at least let us know where you stand from a principled perspective.
Yeah, is it about the individual, or is it about diversity of biological factors?
Collectivism.
And we have to choose between the two. So I mean, I really enjoyed speaking to Tony, and I'm glad he arrived on the scene, and I hope our listeners enjoyed that too.
Yeah, absolutely. So as always, if you enjoyed the show, you can support us on Patreon. And we do appreciate all those people who are already donating towards the show. We also are obviously on all the social media platforms. You can find us on Twitter at @Renegade_Reports, on Facebook, both a group, Renegade Report Discussion Group, where we discuss the podcast. I'm sure this one will pick up quite a lot of traction, and also a page. You can find Ramon at @RomanKavanagh, myself at @Jonathan_Witt. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll get you next time. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.